Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
Welcome to Just Not Good Enough, which is my weekly radio show. And it's all about mental health, as you know. And in particular, mental health at business, in business, and at board and senior management levels.
Yes.
So why don't you just start with a little introduction on yourself?
Okay, so this is where it always gets complicated, but I will do my best.
No, go on, go. We've got loads of time, so take as long as you want.
So I always introduce myself in two parts. People that go to my website will see that there are two introductions to Andrew Solkeld and Andy Solkeld. I'm a chartered accountant, a fellow member. I'm trained at PwC, worked in numerous industry positions. I'm now a director at various companies, invested in a few, etc. And I've basically just built a career kind of helping and coaching and mentoring businesses and owners, entrepreneurs, etc., to help them achieve their dreams, help them tell their stories, as I put it. I've always looked for a one word or a very simple sentence as to how to describe it, and I help people tell stories. I'm also now a member of the British Psychological Society. During COVID, I took it upon myself to learn more about psychology, mental health, and well-being, etc., to kind of add science to my lived experience with it. So I'm in a very very kind of unique position as being both highly qualified in finance and business, but also highly qualified in psychology and people. But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is I have lived with depressive, anxious, and even suicidal ideation symptoms for a large part of my life. I have gone through the ringer, as it were. And about five-ish years ago, I was at the lowest point ever, which is where the suicidal ideation started. And my life was saved by a text message from a friend. And since that point, I have taken it upon myself to do everything I can to kind of help other people in that position, to help people avoid that position. And I started giving talks on it. I've spoken across the UK and internationally. I even wrote a book on it, which was a complete surprise to me. I never thought I'd write a book in my life. And I've now even started businesses around it and so on. And basically, I have done all this just because I want to help other people. And it continues on the kind of part of I'm helping people tell their stories and helping them continue to write them. As a charity known about with regards to suicide surviving called Project Semicolon. I don't know if it's still around, but there are a lot of people that have semicolons. And the idea is that a semicolon is where an author decides the sentence should have stopped, but the author continues to write. And that is very much what being a suicide survivor is like. And I want to continue to, I want to help people to continue to write their stories in whatever regards I can do and so on.
Wow.
So that's a very brief intro to a very complex life.
Yeah. I mean, the parallels with me are, I mean, I read your book, the book I read, I think you've written more than one, was Life is a Four Letter Word.
That's me.
Yeah. And I have to say it's fantastic. Yeah. Well, of course I would say that, wouldn't I? But I normally, when I read books like that, I take notes, and I've written more notes on that book than any other, just because it is so approachable. It's very easy to read it. You've got that the voice in your head as the italics.
Indy, inner Andy. He wasn't named in the book, but I needed a way to refer to him because everyone was like, I just love your inner monologue.
Yeah.
You say everything I'm thinking.
Yeah.
And I just needed a name. And I was like, well, Indy works.
Indy does work, actually. Mm-hmm. And but I'm like you, I'm an accountant. Yeah.
Yep.
I've been through the ringer as well. I don't know if you know anything about my story about Superdry and all that.
Yes.
Yeah. And I've been suicidal as well at the same point.
Yep.
Probably about the same time as yourself, actually, although I'm significantly older than you. And coming through those is really quite hard, isn't it? I mean, you know, you say you live with it all the time. Well, I do as well. But can you sort of just describe a little bit about how it feels? What is it? What's it like?
So a lot of people, like, the easiest way to relate to it, I find, is when people talk about imposter syndrome. So this has become kind of a commonplace conversation about essentially not feeling worthy in your own life, as if you are a fraud, you are about to be found out, all of these things. And what I experience is that on a level of kind of disproportionate representation of it. So it's why I need the two introductions, because whilst I will tell people all the things I have accomplished, some of the things that many people may never do in their lives, like, I appreciate I come from a position of privilege that has enabled me to do these things, but even regardless of achieving them, I do not feel kind of any success from doing them, and so on. So I constantly kind of talk myself down, both internally and externally, like whether it's a defense mechanism or whether it's a kind of just a lack of confidence, I don't know, but that is just a part of it. The depressive symptoms often manifest through not being able to feel things. A lot of people consider it to be just sadness, but actually it's more of an inability to experience happiness or sadness, and kind of a very numb feeling. The anxious symptoms can manifest through either questioning, and you may pick up on this even as I talk, I am constantly analyzing the words I'm saying for how they not only are heard by you, but also how they could be interpreted differently. And after a conversation with anyone, I will go back and replay that in my mind to be like, oh, did I say this? What if they thought that? Similarly to when you send emails and so on, like, oh, what about this? What about that? Have I considered every single possible interpretation or response that could go over this, considering all branches on decision paths and everything?
Why do you do, I'm sorry to interrupt, but why do you do that? Well, I mean, that must cost you a huge amount. And I'm going to refer at some point to spoon theory, because I thought that was just fabulous.
Yes,
And thermodynamics and all that sort of stuff. But why do you do that analysis? Why do you need to do that, do you think?
No. And that's one of the things. You don't need to do it at all. But for me, a lot of my insecurities and a lot of the issues with my mental health come from wanting to be accepted by others. I was bullied as a child. I was kind of ostracized and put on the edges. I therefore developed hobbies and interests that I could do by myself that would interest me, keep my mind occupied and everything. And a lot of what I do and how things have changed in my life is because I seek acceptance through other people. So whether that's through ensuring that I do right by them and that I do something properly in the kind of grander schemes of things, whether it's about wanting people to externally validate my actions and things like that. And whilst it is unnecessary, it is a part of my life that has kind of developed, but only through living it, experiencing it, being able to talk about it and being able to kind of understand it a little bit better, can I talk about it so freely and say, well, actually, this is what I do, this is why I do it, but I can keep it in check now because I understand it so much better through actually investing the time in myself and in the kind of knowledge around the subjects.
Yeah, yeah, I get that, because I try to do the same thing. I try to understand things as much as I can. And so where are you? I mean, it's interesting what you just said, and what the words that came to mind were people pleaser. And
yep.
And I met a guy the other day who said that he was a people pleaser, and you're constantly on the lookout to help others, please others, get the validation and so on. Where are you on accepting compliments then?
So I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a people pleaser per se, because I will very much speak my mind and have my own opinions on things. I won't change who I am for others. That was something I did when I was younger and less kind of wise to what does right by me. But I do try to help people and so on. And I try to see the best in people. Where I am on kind of those sorts of things is I will do what I can, where I can, to kind of help people become better versions of themselves and help, and through that become a better version of myself and so on. One of the things I'm a very firm believer in is that if each of us just puts some good into the world each day and makes, and there is kind of a net positive increase in the happiness of people you are connected to over a day, if everyone does that, the world as a whole becomes a better and happier place for all involved in it.
It's a tough job,
isn't
it?
That's what it is because an incredibly tough job.
The bad behavior, I mean, I see it every day. I see good behavior as well, but I also see a lot of bad behavior every day. Just people just completely inconsiderate. And, you know, I mean, it doesn't cost anything to say thank you, does it? You know, or just when you're driving, you put your hand up just to let somebody say, and yet people don't do it. And I think, oh, for God's sake, and I get angry about it. It's costing me energy. Because of their behavior. They don't care, do they?
I wouldn't say they don't care. I would say they may not be wise to it. A lot of these things come from understanding, and one of the things that limits understanding is time. And as we get older, as we move through our careers, we start losing time and the ability and the affordance that having time gives us to having a better understanding and a better kind of appreciation for not only our place in the world, but our place with regards to others and their place in the world and so on. And that, and again, that's just something that comes with kind of experience and investment in these things, and not everyone does that, unfortunately.
No. You said a little earlier you went through the ringer. I mean,
yes.
What did you mean by that? Was that when you were in the profession, or was that after that? Or how did that? Just talk to us a bit about that.
I was referring to that mostly with regards to my mental health state during a very tough time in my life. There's a chapter in the book Life is a Four-Letter Word that was mentioned that goes through a lot of this in detail. But essentially, I refer to it as my seven failures. And note that these weren't actual failures. These were my own perception of my position. So I will say I describe them as failures, but they weren't failures. They were just objective facts. And this is where I felt that I had failed my partner at the time. I had failed my cats, my parents, my brothers, my friends, my career, and I think that's six. And then
I'm not counting.
Yeah, it's hard to remember because there were some tenuous jumps to get to seven, but seven just felt the appropriate number. And finally, because of my depressive symptoms and everything like that, I couldn't feel anything. And one of the things that I always feel is very important for us as humans is our ability to feel emotions. Like we have an evolved emotional intellect and so on. And being detached from that almost removes a lot of the humanity from yourself. And that is where I felt. And that put me in an incredibly poor state, mentally and physically. that led to severe suicidal ideation and everything like that. And I came back from it. I was lucky. I was supported by people, by friends, by family, etc. But in that moment, it was basically life took hold and it was almost out of my hands because of the emotional state I was in.
Going slightly before that, because that, I mean, similar to me, in this, that was a culmination of certain things happening. You know,
yes.
And you get to a point where you crack and boom, that's it, you've gone.
Yes, exactly.
But for me, it didn't happen like in a short period of time. It happened over almost decades, actually. And interesting, you said you bullied at school, so was I.
Yeah.
You know, and you feel inadequate and you feel, hence why this program's called Just Not Good Enough, you know. So was there anything that you could see or spot going along in your early career, perhaps the behavior of certain people at work or... You know, you bring it out in your book about the competitiveness of life going back, you know, high school never ends, or what I think is the title of part of
yes.
it. You know, was it, what was that journey like for you? Oh, that's a horrible word, sorry.
So what I would, like, I always caveat this. I do not look back negatively on what happened. I will never blame anyone else for what happened. A lot of it is just my response and interpretation of what happened around me. But yeah, there are things that that are not kind of conducive to mentally healthy cultures in workplaces and so on. One of the things that I grew up with through education was the ability to kind of, was like, you are smart, you progress, you do well, you get the highest grades, you move on, you progress, you get the highest grades, et cetera, et cetera. Like everything is a competition. We have a fantastic culture through education and through work where we grade people, we rank them against each other. And that always will create a level of competition amongst people. And therefore people are not necessarily happy in what they have achieved. They want to know their relative position amongst their peers and so on. And this kind of ranking leads to competition, whether intended or not. People start looking towards the people around them and so on. I actually started doing some research for another book and so on about this that we can maybe come on to later. But largely, we look to everyone around us. And when you're in a... in your early career, a lot of the things you are kind of almost societally pressured into are to progress quickly, to kind of climb through the ranks, to challenge yourself. I mean, how many times have people said to like anyone else in the firm, oh, this would be great for your experience and so on. And like, actually, maybe it wouldn't be great for your experience. Maybe it's just that some work needs doing and they need help doing it. Maybe don't sugarcoat it, just be honest. But you know what I mean? Like, all this pressure, there is a pressure amongst workplaces. Now, particularly when I was doing it and when I was starting my career, this was around trying to remember which one it was. It was the kind of first recession of the 2000s, was it 2008?
Yeah, it was 2008-9.
Which within professional services, where I was training as an accountant, that creates like suddenly you are like, oh, well, everything changes because you are an advisor. You are non-core to a kind of your client's needs. Obviously, accounting services, audit services, tax services, all of these are necessary, but because they are not kind of part of a profit center for an industry organization, they are kind of an operational cost, as you will. People do not want to pay a lot, and therefore there is pressure created within organizations to do things more efficiently, to spend less time, to not necessarily cut corners, but to kind of ensure things are done within the timescales the client needs so that the relationship is maintained and so on. And this just creates additional pressure and so on. And this pressure can build up within a person. And I certainly felt that pressure. also because of the competitive nature, and this is kind of nuanced in accounting, particularly when you're doing exams, failure at an exam can result in losing your job potentially and repaying fees and everything like that. And it creates this culture of trying to stand out and trying to be better than peers and everything like that. Now, some people buy into it, some people don't, some people are just happy to get on with things, but it is encouraged. And one of the things that always stood out to me, and this happens the world over, is people would compete, and their words, which can often be kind of negative, shall we say, basically bullying, in the term that we remember from school, gets passed off as what is now called banter, and it suddenly becomes acceptable. And I personally do not approve of that. I say all banter is bullying. If someone is not comfortable with it, do not do it. Do not say it. Like, if you are impacting someone's well-being and their mental health through your words, you should really look at yourself and kind of change how you're doing that. But at the time, you're kind of in the middle of it, so you can't step back and see this. So that kind of pressure to grow, outperform, stand out, be different, certainly did impact me. And all of these things require time. And this is something that I actually learned from a good friend of mine at PwC, is as an accountant, as a young professional and so on, you are money rich and time poor. And the time that you have starts having increased value and things like that. And it is up to everyone to decide where they sit on that time money seesaw. How much time do you want for yourself versus how much time are you going to spend earning money for the lifestyle you want to live and so on. And I sacrificed a lot of my time to strive for money and so on. And again, the less time you have, the more pressure you experience and the more it can impact on your well-being and create stress and so on. And I can only talk about kind of what I know about stress now, almost 15, 20 years later in the hindsight.
So I'm laughing because I shouldn't laugh, but I am laughing because this resonates so well with me.
Yeah. And because of all these things and what it means for stress and understanding stress at a psychological level and what it does to the human body has totally reshaped the way that I think about stress in the workplace, stress in life, everything like that. And it's one of the big things that I am doing everything I can to help assess, understand, and address stress with companies that I work with and so on.
Sorry to interrupt again, but did you, as you were going through your PwC career, and I guess you, I don't know, did you work for somebody after that as well?
Yes, I went out. I stayed at PwC. I didn't go to another accounting firm. I just moved into industry where I then specialized on kind of business intelligence, reporting, analytics, right. Everything okay. Like that.
So as you go up the tree, those pressures get worse and the behavior potentially gets worse and the banter gets slightly more passive aggressive and then ultimately it becomes definitely passive aggressive because people are competing with you for, you know, there's four of you or so competing for one position and only one can win.
Yes.
So, I mean, obviously that affected you in the same way that it would have affected me, and you suddenly start to doubt yourself and you think, you know, all of those things that you talked about a bit earlier. But was there ever an occasion that you saw where that sort of behavior was called out and said, hold on a minute, guys, you know, you can't talk to somebody like that? And from a third party almost, not necessarily from the person who was being spoken to.
I am struggling to recall anything from kind of personal experience. I have kind of stood out for things myself and said, you shouldn't say that, like that's wrong and so on, like you can't say these things to people. I believe from my work recently, culture is getting better with these regards. But there has been a large culture shift recently, particularly on the back of COVID and working from home and the isolation and loneliness that people felt in those circumstances. I would not have wished it upon the world at all. It was devastating. But there has been a more positive shift towards more mentally healthy cultures as a result of it. And one of the things I was saying at the time was, I really, really hope we don't try to rush back to the culture that was before, because actually we've gained quite a lot from the understanding of the experiences that we've gone through and so on.
But there's still the pockets of bad behaviour, isn't there? I mean, yes, you're right.
Yes.
Absolutely right. The cultures have moved, they have shifted, and people are far more considerate of others, I think. But there's still that, well, I'll say passive-aggressive again. There's still that type of behaviour goes on, and it's not just in work. It's broadly everywhere.
Yes, I would say that culture has not fully adapted and not fully addressed kind of what it means to be mentally healthy and so on. And I think one of the this is a personal bugbear of mine, and I know I'm separating it right now bit to emphasize the point about things being mentally healthy, but I really want us to drop the mental from mental health.
Yes,
and us just accept it being health.
Yes,
because
I agree.
It is just health.
Yeah, it needs a rebrand, doesn't it, basically?
Yeah, yeah. It's all just health. And separating out still creates levels of stigma towards it, whether intended or not. The perception amongst people is still negative towards how people with mental illness will be treated, even though in reality they are often not treated any differently to someone with a physical illness, etc. But the perception of it is still unchanged, and that's a concerning part about it.
How do we get over that stigma? How do we get across that actually it's okay to have a mental health condition?
So I actually did some research on this as part of my qualification as a psychologist. I looked at mental illness stigma towards people with mental illness within professional services, because obviously this is my experience there. And one of the things that stood out was, as I just said, the people do. There is no significant difference between how people treat someone with a physical illness to how people treat someone with a mental illness, to just treating someone with symptoms of but not diagnosed and so on. That was kind of the crux of the case study, and it was fascinating the way that is seen. That kind of I talked through in the kind of extension of the research, the way that was highlighted as one of the most effective ways to address this is through people sharing lived experience from people in similar professions, people in similar positions, essentially normalizing that these things happen within your peer group, and normalizing that it's okay to stand up and talk about things, to protect yourself, to defend yourself, et cetera, et cetera. Which is exactly why things like what we are doing today, where we are two professionals, two experienced kind of directors in our positions, obviously different kind of skill sets, different career trajectories and so on. But the very fact that we are here today talking about these things, sharing a true lived experience and saying, it's not okay that these things happen, we have to talk about these things, is what inspires people to actually talk about these things. And this takes us all the way back to the very first thing, the very first kind of things I was saying when I came on, which was very much it's why I will always answer the call when someone says, do you want to come and speak about this?
Yeah, but it's still real, though, isn't it? In work, you know, and I know because I've got two sons and
yeah,
you know, I don't know whether they have got a mental health condition or not, but I suspect they may be on the boundaries of that. And I still see, you know, they would never say anything because of the stigma around it and the fear for their job. And, you know, the statistics play out for themselves about, you know, if somebody puts their hand up, they're gone within, or they're demoted within, you know, a certain period of time thereafter. And so we still have that fear. So what can we do to get people at work to put their hand up and say, come on then, I've got a problem here, I need some help?
So one of the first thing, like a very, this is a logistical thing. We need to remove the line that are in most contracts that says of sound mind.
I read that. Are they still there?
Some of them are still there.
Really? Of sound mind, that's like a power of attorney contract, for Christ's sake.
Exactly. And a lot of places have now ensured these are removed and so on, but that is one of the lines that terrifies people from with regards to their mental health suffering and so on. So that's a very practical thing that any business can do. Just make sure that your contracts do not include language like that, because that alone is damaging to employees. One of the things I have been championing for a long time is that we need a counterpoint to HR within a business. And this sounds very, very strange, because a lot of people see HR as working for the people. Whereas as someone that has seen it, I often see HR as protecting the business from the people. They ensure legal contracts are in place. They ensure safety is up to spec.
Yes.
I'm
sorry, but this perspective is just, I mean, I'm laughing again because it's just so true, isn't it? And yeah. I've never really realised it before until you've just said it. But yeah, anyway, carry on, please.
It protects the business from the people. It's perceived as protecting the people from the business, but actually it ensures compliance with the kind of organisational standards, all the rules that need to be met, et cetera, et cetera. And what I've been a champion of and have said whenever I get the chances, I think we need a counterpoint to that now. I think businesses need someone. I haven't yet settled on whether it's internal or external to an organization, because each comes with their faults, but you need someone that is the champion of the people within the business, that protects the people from the business, just as HR protects the business from the people. And so on. And you need someone that anyone can go to that is just that kind of like, I will be here, I will support your mental health, your well-being, your career, and I will make sure that whatever you need saying is raised to care for you as an individual. And so I don't know whether this is having, like, there's loads of terms you could put to it, but whether it's an internal coach or an internal kind of therapist or organizational psychologist, whatever term, just someone that is there saying, like, actually, people need this. How are we going to champion the people and make the people stronger within an organization? And like, you can dress it up how you like. It's just, that's one of the things I've kind of believed for a long time.
Isn't that like an intervention, if you like, from the outside? Whereas if we can get to a point where an organizational culture of itself is aware and accessible and supportive and so on, rather than having this external intervention, and I appreciate that you've probably got to have that first, but
yes,
shouldn't it be where the culture itself is, actually, every line manager needs to think about mental health and well-being and look after their staff and everybody else for that matter?
Agreed. Like the goal, the vision, as you will, is to, like, and this is one of the things that one of the organizations I've recently helped found is, it basically just maximize the human experience of work. Like, not necessarily maximize work, but the human experience of it. Make people happier, make people feel better. If everything in the organization is pulling towards that, then everyone will live a more fulfilled, a more ultimately productive, effective, enjoyable work life, which will lead to a better home life. There will be lower stress all around, everything will be assessed. And yeah, ultimately, you build a culture that does that, and it will self-perpetuate, because everyone wants to protect a culture that is kind of a virtuous circle, as it were.
What about at board level, though? Because I mean, my experience when I was at board level was pretty grim half the time, because it's behind closed doors. It's like the behaviour can be frankly appalling. The bullying that goes on is ridiculous. The side comments are ridiculous, and they're quite hurtful. And I used to feel shot every time I had a board meeting. Yeah. This is when we went public. This wasn't before we went public. And
yeah,
so I mean, that's where it starts, isn't it?
Yes, culture kind of, a lot of research shows that culture essentially is created by the founders, by the board, by the CEO, whoever is that person or peoples that everyone looks to in an organization. That is where culture comes from. And if culture at the top is sour, then it will spread throughout regardless of what kind of is instigated beneath. So you can have the best like HR, learning and development team, like health team, safety team, whoever it is that are all trying to look after the people. But if the kind of the inspirational and charismatic leaders at the top are fake, as it were, are leading by words but not by example, then that will perpetuate through the organization. Because if one person that they interact with suddenly like, oh well, actually it's okay to kind of demand extra from people, or it's okay to push people too hard because I am being pushed too hard, I'm having unrealistic expectations put on my time, therefore I need to put unrealistic expectations on other people's time, that is like, that perpetuates throughout. So it's why this culture shift takes a lot of time, because it does start at the top and then needs to be kind of flush through an organization.
But doesn't then all of the other things that the organizations are currently doing just pay lip service to it? Because on the one hand, they're going to their well-being workshops or whatever, whatever it happens to be, and yet they're still seeing the same behavior of the people at the top and thinking, well, if I want to be successful, that's how I've got to be. Well, I've got to do this as part of my job because that's what I'm asked to do. But actually, it doesn't really make any difference. Doesn't matter.
Yes, there is so much that can be said about this.
Well, go on then. Go on, Andy.
So,
go on.
So I always I refer to this as the kind of the professional's dilemma, or basically it's a causality paradox. So someone sees or experiences something bad in an organization. They then look to the people around them as to whether it's okay to say anything. So whether they should say I'm struggling or whether they shouldn't. And they see no one else doing it. This is why I call it the dilemma, because it's very similar to the prisoner's dilemma. Should you talk? Shouldn't you talk?
Mm-hmm.
And so on. So what happens is, because no one else is talking, they choose not to talk, which perpetuates it within themselves. And therefore, you have this circle of not talking. What also happens is the organization is saying, we want to change. So leadership is saying, we want to change. We want to do better by our people. Tell us what we need to do. Okay, tell us how we can help and we will do it. And like every leadership team I've worked with has said this, that they always want to do better by their people, because ultimately, and particularly in professional services, their business is defined by their people. We cannot automate everything just yet, otherwise every business would be a solopreneur kind of business. we need our people. So every business wants to do right by their people as best they can. But no one's talking about it. Okay, so what they do is they say, I need to make a change because I want to do best by my people, but I don't have good information. But I know, because everyone is telling me this and the world is telling me this, that people are stressed. Okay, so what they do is they say, okay, well, I'm going to address the symptoms of stress, not the causes of stress, the symptoms of stress. And so what do? They say, let's go for a park run. Let's go for a coffee together. Let's do yoga. This is always my joke. Like, doing yoga is great, don't get me wrong, but setting up a yoga class for your employees may not be the best solution.
As somebody like me who lives with mental health, the thought of doing a yoga class was the worst possible thing that I could do.
Exactly. But here's the crux. The employees then see that they're saying, do yoga, and not looking at the root causes of what's causing the stress. Because ultimately, the root causes of all stress in an organization come from a lack of resources, a lack of knowledge, a lack of people, a lack of time.
And profit motive.
Well, it demands resources. And this is where it comes. This is where understanding the psychology now is very important to me, because actually it's entirely demands resources, and the business's motivations are different to the individual's motivations, which is where the monetary and profit comes from. But back to the original point, because the employees are seeing that the business and leadership do not understand the problem, they are telling them to do yoga when actually yoga takes time out of their day, whether it's in the middle of the workday or at the end of the workday, takes time out of their day, which further lowers their demand resources balance. They're like, oh, well, they just don't understand what the problem is, so I'm not going to talk about it any further. And the cycle perpetuates again and again and again. And this is why it's such a tricky problem to solve, because ultimately, the way that problem solves is for people to talk about it. But everyone is terrified of raising their head above the parapet in case they're the one that gets shot down. Even though everyone in leadership is saying, we want to help, but we don't have we don't have information, so we can't act. And it's so, like, I do not envy any business in that position, because ultimately, organizations in theory operate, they often don't, but in theory they operate in the kind of the hypological like mindset stance, where everything is, does it generate profit, etc., does it lead to the outcomes that the organization wants, and everything should guide towards that. Yes, there is often a lot of emotion in these things, and therefore if they are operating like that, they can't make any change that would net impact on profit without the information to support the fact that it will generate better well-being, et cetera, which leads to kind of better efficiency, effectiveness, and productivity and all that, which is why one of the things that I'm big on is helping organizations access this, helping run research within organizations to help them understand what is happening, understands these demands, resources, balances, to help them actually assess what is going on, how things can be better, and therefore, and then make the changes to improve and so on, and do better by their people. Because if that's what they want to do, they need the information to act on it.
Yeah, because the commercial case is pretty clear, isn't it, in terms of return on investment, if you want to put it in those accounting terms.
Yeah, in a pure productivity sense, people that are happier are more productive. Like research has shown that the kind of world over, if someone is happier and more and has a good balance of their demands and resources to address things, they are more productive, they are more effective, they are more efficient, they experience less stress. And with less stress, there's a whole raft of kind of benefits, least of all the health benefit of not having stress in your life and so on. and all these things suddenly lead to a better operational business.
So where do the role models come from then in this? Because you need those, don't you, in the same way that, you know, footballers are role models for the game, both good and bad, frankly. So where are the role models in business?
So the role models in business, this is the tricky point. This is the bit that I was saying, like, I don't know how you create this counterpoint to HR that is the role model that needs to be defined, because ultimately people don't necessarily, like, it's a very ethereal concept to be able to put out there. But the real role models, the real ones that will make a tangible difference, are the people that are leading organizations that are saying, you know what, I had the absolute worst time in my career when I was in your shoes. This is what I was experiencing. This is what I felt, how I experienced it, how I kind of struggled through, and ultimately got to where I am. And essentially sharing their journey, telling their story, because that is how people kind of, that is what resonates, is like, okay, this is what is what often happens right now. This is the hardest point in a career within a firm. Like, that there was always this conversation within the accounting firms, is like, which grade is the hardest, or which grade are you pushed the most in? And almost every department was kind of like, it's always at the manager level, where you have just moved into looking after some people, but you have your own work, the responsibilities of other work, and also the kind of want to try to step up further. And having people that are able to share those experiences and to kind of be like, this is how things change, this is what changed for me.
Can I just interject? Because,
yeah, carry on.
I mean, but you're telling your story really clearly, yeah, and you have done in the words that you've written, not I've written. And I'm trying to do the same thing here. But the question is that, would I ever have told my story whilst I was still in post? And the answer is probably no, because I'd be frightened, I'd be fearful, all the things that I'd achieved, you know, could suddenly be taken away from me. You know, you've got your family, your mortgage, your blah, 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 all these sorts of things going on. So you keep your head down and you persevere and you battle through it. And it comes out clearly in your book as well. You hide behind your personality and people think, actually, everything's fine. But it isn't.
Correct. Well, there's a song lyric that always kind of gets me when everyone talks about the fear. It's from a song called "I Got Love" by the King Blues. No one will know about it except that it was played on a Felix advert for one summer. if you're a cat lover, you might remember it. Yeah. But the line goes, I think it's, "The frightened fall as often, yet far closer than the brave." But basically, no matter how brave you think you are, kind of being resilient, standing firm, kind of just being like, I'm just gonna head down, shoulder on, actually what you're doing is you're damaging yourself doing that. You are internalizing all the struggles further, and you are essentially taking the chance that where you get to is less bad than where you are currently. Whereas actually, if you take the chance to stand up for yourself, to actually say, no, this isn't right, no, I am not doing well, this is impacting my health, my home, my everything, as you said, like, are you willing to wager your life against being against your career? Because I'll tell you what, after having lived it and gone through it, I'm not. Like, I'm happy to be alive. I'm happy to experience much less stress than I did one day. And I would wager everyone would be happier, maybe not in the immediate kind of dealing with it and what it does, but ultimately like, would you risk like serious physical health consequences as a result of stress? And believe me, there are many. Would you risk all of that just for that little bit?
So it comes down to personal choice, do you think, in terms of the culture might be changing at work, but actually it's not good for me. And you're very clear in your book as well about push and pull decisions.
Yeah.
And don't make push decisions because you make the wrong one, but make, you know, think very carefully about what it is you want to do because it's about what makes you happy.
Yes. Make a decision for yourself. Don't make a decision because an organization is telling you to make it. And don't make a decision because society is telling you to make it. Make a decision because it improves you, and it is what you want. One of the talks I gave to the Institute of Chartered Accountants and in a couple of other organizations, I called it the net present value of happiness, which you'll probably resonate with.
I bet they understood that.
Well, exactly. Essentially, the crux of it is kind of like, right, we put off decisions that make us happy. So in this case, I am stressed, I'm struggling, but it will be better in the long run, and so on. And net present value is a common kind of accounting, economics term, where essentially having money gain interest for you over the long term, like you basically count back and say, right, this is worth more in the future because it will have gained all the interest benefits and so on. But what I was saying is, okay, that's great, but there is no happiness bank. There is no happiness government bonds or anything like that. Ultimately, happiness has an immediate value. And the immediate value is, what is it right now? Because ultimately, you are going to have to weigh up the immediate value of happiness in the present, because you can't leverage future happiness now to have more in the future. But that's what we try to do. We try to say, you know what, it's going to be a really tough 3 to 5 years in this position, and I'm going to push myself really hard. But at the end of it, I'm going to get that promotion, and I'm going to feel much happier because then I'm going to be in this position, this position, this position. But actually, you could put all that effort in and not get the promotion. You could put all that effort in and get fired. You could put all that effort in and, because of the stress, die on your way there. And that's really, really sad. And I'm sorry to break it to you, but those things can happen.
Yeah.
And therefore, if you delay your happiness, that is a conscious choice that you are making.
A lot of people don't realise that, though, do they? They don't see it like that because you've clearly thought about it and analysed it, and that's in your nature to do that. But a lot of people don't think about that, do they? They just think, oh, crap, I've got to get to 5 o'clock and I can go home.
Exactly. And people talk about living in the moment, but most of us don't actually live in the moment. Most of us live in the little bit in the future where it's kind of like, oh, well, I'm going to get, like right now, this past month, I have been saying, well, I'm just going to get to the holidays at Christmas because that's going to be my break time.
Yeah.
Now, that is not long-term kind of delaying. That is just there is a lot that I need to do. There's a lot I need to achieve. Therefore, I am conscious that I am going to feel worse now, but I will achieve these things, and it's only for a short amount of time. The problem is when you don't make those decisions consciously and refer back to those conscious decisions. And one of the biggest things everyone struggles with, everyone, like no matter how successful you are, no matter where in your kind of where in your career you are, whether you're just starting out or whether you're kind of senior or even retiring, is saying, just because something was right for me then in the past does not mean it is right for me now. And therefore, being able to look at yourself, look at where you are and whether it is right for you in the present, that's a real skill that many people kind of forget about. They're kind of like, oh, well, I've made this decision, therefore I'm stuck with it, therefore this is what I'm doing. Was actually being able to say, no, is this right for me right now? Is this doing what I want it to do right now?
Isn't it true, though, that people, when they're thinking in the moment, actually refer back to all the stuff that they've done in their life, you know, and the three words that spring to mind are shame, guilt, and regret, right? And you said in your book, and this again resonates so clearly with me, tiny little things that happened to me, and I had two this morning on the way here, happened in the past, probably 30 or 40 years ago, and I still got this wave of shame because it just popped into my head for some reason. And it destroys you.
Yep. Like, it is, like, I refer to, I can't remember the actual terms around it. I always joke about this as being the curse of memory, whereas because you have a good memory, because you care about your actions, you will look back and you will be like, oh, I remember that. I should have done better then. I should have done right by those people. In hindsight, I made this decision, that decision, etc., and I could have done better. And it's because we care. And yes, it will keep coming. It will be there. It will affect us. It will kind of be part of us. The key thing is to remember that the past is written. Like, we cannot change the past. Mm-hmm. We can learn from it, and we can change our present based off it, but the only time we can act is now. The only time where we can do, like, to make those changes is right now in the present. And it's why, again, another, like, a lot of things I have resonate with music for me. It's about being happy in the meantime and so on. Just being in the present. Yes, be aware of the future and what you want to achieve with it. Yes, look at the past and what you can learn from it. But actually, actions take place now. And you need to use the information you have at present rather than hypotheticals in the future or, like, rose-tinted memories from the past, etc. Yeah.
I mean, for me, it was therapy that taught me how to do that, actually, is to deal with, because I was really struggling. I thought I didn't need therapy because I'm an arrogant, macho finance guy. And I was persuaded to by my wife. And actually, I now deal with those things and say, and I don't ever experience regret. I get those waves of shame and guilt and so on, because that's an emotional response. But I don't regret anything because, like you said, it's written, it's done, it's happened. Yeah. I can't change it. So, right, learn from it. And again, that comes through very clearly from you.
Yeah. Like, one of the things I am a big proponent of is everyone should have a therapist. Everyone should speak to a therapist. And I'm not saying walk in and get kind of Freudian psychoanalyzed and everything like that. It's more have someone in your life, whether a coach or a therapist or a psychologist or whatever word you want to put to it, because there are so many words for these things nowadays. Have someone that you can speak to who will be objective, that won't give you the benefit of a doubt because they're your friend or your family. Have someone that will say, did you think about this? Why did you do that? What are you going to do now about it?
Yeah, without judgment,
because that objectivity and that ability to have someone, not care is probably the right word. I was going to say care isn't the right word, but care is the right word.
Yeah.
Care about you as an individual objectively. That is empowering, and everyone deserves to feel that kind of benefit in their lives. And to any, like, to speak to the audience more, anyone that is in their career, like a professional senior leadership team, like board of directors, find a therapist, find a counselor or a coach, find someone you can talk to. It's one of the things I've started offering where I will actually work with these people and actively help them, not in a way to kind of go through trauma or go through kind of like decision making, but just to help people express what they are feeling. Because sometimes, particularly in senior positions, because you've gone through the like hyperlogical growth through an organization, you're following all the rules and everything like that, people find it hard to articulate how they are feeling and what they're experiencing. And sometimes just being able to put it into words and put it down on paper immediately kind of neutralizes its effect on you.
But we're back to stigma, aren't we? We're back to stigma again. And you see, I almost end on this question, but I'm going to ask it now anyway. We've done an hour. So anyway, I have this sort of I'd call it the plastic bag moment, right? So when the government intervened in plastic bags and put a 10p tax on it, 90% of it disappeared overnight, right?
Yes.
So if you could have a plastic bag moment at board level, what would you do? What would it be, do you think? Nobody's actually really answered this question, I might say. But I mean, I have an idea, but I'd just be interested in your views on it.
So I would go back to what I said before. I would hire an internal coach / therapist, whatever you want to put to it. That their sole responsibility is to be the voice of the people and their existence within the organization, and have that person basically be the champion for the well-being of the people. And I would give them full remit to kind of raise whatever problems there are and to look for solutions that can work with HR and with operational things under a budget that is kind of like, we want to maximize people's experience of work and I want you to champion it. And that would be, honestly, that would, and they like, maybe they're a trained coach, maybe they're a trained psychologist and you're essentially bringing in an occupational psychologist, maybe anything like that. But I would have someone that is just there to care for the people. Mm. And I would put that in every C-suite, every board of directors. And that person would be the champion, and they would be what connects the rest of the leadership team to every other person in the organization, rather than being, say, slightly distant or slightly detached from it because of how many rungs or change in the leadership ladder.
Mm. You see, that my idea to answer my own question is. Yep. Wouldn't it be fantastic if your coach, which I think is a fantastic idea, your coach could talk to a chief executive or a chairman and get them to tell their story? You did hint at it a little earlier. Tell their story publicly in their organization, says, I really struggle with my mental health and I'm feeling shit today.
Yep.
I'm sorry, but I can't do this today. I need to go home. Wouldn't that be brilliant? Because that creates the role model. And yet, I don't know of any PLC directors who've done that whilst in post.
This is one of the things, whilst I said they're appointed to the C-suite or whatever term, board, whatever, the rest of the C-suite are also members and employees of the organization, and therefore their well-being is the responsibility of this person. So not only are they looking after every person further down, they're also looking after the C-suite and so on.
Isn't there a distinction between director and non-exec director? Because the non-exec directors have a very specific role, don't they, in terms of governance and all that, and looking after minority shareholders.
Yes.
So and if there's a person around the table, an executive around the table who's not up to it, then they don't give a toss, frankly. They'll just get somebody who can do it, won't they? That's not right.
Exactly. It's not right. If they're not up to it, why? Like, are the demands resources balanced?
Yes.
Is this person supported correctly? That they may be qualified to do the job, but if they're not able to do it, what is the limiting factor? Because, like, yes, there are situations where someone is appointed and it was an incorrect appointment and that needs addressing.
Yes.
Yes. These things exist. But if this person is struggling to do their job, what is causing it? And who is championing them in the situation? Because ultimately, every other person will be like, well, I've got my own problems. I can't, like, because every department, siloed or not, will be looking after their own problems and looking out for number one. And this is why you need people in an organization so that people don't feel alone. And the higher up you get, the more lonely the experience is.
And the tougher it, the tougher it is. It's the more competitive. You know, I mean, it speaks for itself, doesn't it? And the more you've got at risk as well.
Yeah, because ultimately these things affect careers. These things affect kind of livelihoods and so on. But that's why you need the support of someone who will help you in this. And that's why you need, that's why I stand by it. And yes, people will see this as a pure operational cost of having someone at that sort of level that will champion these positions. But ultimately, if this person is doing their job, then that person that is struggling, whether it's C-suite or anywhere down the ladder, they will then become more productive because they will be happier. They will have their demands and resources balanced. They will have the support they need. They will have the time needed, the resources needed, and the knowledge available to them to address the problems they're having.
Yeah.
And if when they have all the appropriate things around them, and then if they're still not able to do it, that's when you can look at the, okay, well, maybe we need someone more appropriate for the role. But until you have the correct balance of these things, all you're essentially looking for is someone that is willing to persevere and struggle through and take all the burden internally rather than addressing it externally and building the correct job role and so on.
Yeah.
And that is a problem the world over in all organizations. Is, and like, I will not monologue on this, but fundamentally it comes down to capitalism.
Yes.
And
we need a capitalism. Somebody came on the show a while ago, said we need a capitalism 2.0.
Yes.
And they're bloody right. Absolutely right. The capitalist model is broken from what we're talking about now.
Yes. Like the capitalist model works perfectly for the people that have resources. And because their resources keep growing, and essentially what happens under capitalism is we trade resources for time. And what happens is, as people accumulate resources under capitalism, they expend those resources to buy the time of other people. And time is both infinite universally, but finite in our lives. And therefore, whenever someone is selling their time for a level they are unhappy with the kind of value of, that creates friction.
You're right. I'm conscious we are beginning to sort of run out of time, but it's been absolutely fascinating. But on that note about time and resources, talk to me about your spoon theory.
So spoon theory isn't my theory. This is a theory from the internet. And it was one I was introduced to many, many years ago when someone I was very close to was suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome. So this is kind of it's a feeling of exhaustion and so on. And spoon theory very, very simply says things like, well, imagine each day you are allocated a set number of spoons. That is your energy for the day. And it costs, say, one spoon to have a shower, two spoons if you need to kind of wash your hair because it's longer than mine. it takes a certain number of spoons to make dinner. All these sorts of things. There's an amount of spoons that get spent. Now imagine... And that is what all of us do every day. There's an amount of energy we kind of wake up with and that we're able to kind of function with. And when we overexert ourselves, we spend extra spoons and we go into a spoon deficit and so on. And what we do is, if we go into a spoon deficit, we either eat more because that replenishes spoons, gives us more energy, or we we sleep longer and eat into the time of the next day to replenish it that way, or we eventually kind of borrow them from the next day, the next day, the next day. And what they said in chronic fatigue is, to understand chronic fatigue is, imagine spoon allocation. The energy allocation of a normal person is 50, but the energy allocation of someone with chronic fatigue is, say, 30 or 25. They can do the same amount, they can do the same tasks, but because they have a lower allocation each day, they suddenly they run out of their energy faster, and therefore they have to be conscious of resting in between actions. Now, what I did when I kind of took this, and like this, it really made me think about how I'm spending my time and how I'm spending kind of my resources, my energy, the stress I'm putting on myself, everything like that. But what I realized is actually there's bigger understandings that you can learn from this, particularly when it comes to things like, okay, well, I'm going to exert myself extreme. So like, this is when I'd say, like, you go on a weekend away and you do like loads of activities and you're like, okay, fine, I will do these things and I will borrow spoons from tomorrow or the day after. I will borrow them all. And then at the end of it, I will rest more. I will kind of just sleep in. I will do nothing. So I won't spend spoons on the following days to kind of to catch up and so on, to recover back to normal, as it were. And there's loads of other things that you can kind of see from this, in the like there are no spoon banks. You can't just bank spoons for the next day.
There's no ATM, is there, for spoons?
Yeah, exactly. No. But what the biggest learning I had was, as you work harder, this is where it applies to business and for people that are pushing themselves, is you will work longer hours. You will therefore spend more spoons, and you borrow them from tomorrow. And you borrow, and so you're continuously borrowing. And as a financier, I immediately went, oh, this is like taking on debt. Yeah. I'm taking on spoon debt from the future. And I am slowly paying off my spoon debt by little bits of rest, but ultimately I'm taking it on. But eventually you'll reach a point where you're starting days with zero spoons because of the debt. And in a financial situation, when your debt is too large and you can't meet the covenant agreements, typically like bad things happen, like very bad things. You can go bankrupt, you could insolvent, et cetera, et cetera. But you refinance. So you'll be like, okay, well, I need better covenant terms. I need this, I need that, blah, blah, blah. But you don't get that in real life. You don't get to say, fine, I've had enough. I need to refinance my spoons. Let's go. No, that's when you hit burnout. That's when you hit kind of the point of breaking. That's where you literally cannot function because you have pushed yourself too hard.
Yeah.
And once I realized that and the implications of what this little thing that I found on a forum online, I honestly, whoever came up with this is brilliant. No, yeah. I can't tell you why it's spoons. But you suddenly realize that actually you do genuinely need to take care of yourself.
I'm a lot older than you, right? But I still think I can do all the sorts of things that I used to do in my 30s.
I can't, right?
And I'm beginning to realize, having read your book, and I'm beginning to realize that actually I can't. So I need to take some time out for myself to do certain things. And I go to the theater a lot and blah, blah, blah. But even that still costs you spoons, because you're going to get home late. You probably had a couple of beers. You don't sleep very well.
Yeah.
You know, and it goes on and on and on. And then is it any wonder that in 2016 I had a breakdown? Because my spoon deficit was massive.
And this is what I say is like, okay, now imagine if, so you've got your spoon deficit, you've been living your life, but now imagine that every year you go beyond 30 or whatever age I picked, you have one less spoon each day, because that's what growing old is. And ultimately you end up with much fewer spoons, like exponentially based on kind of how old you get.
So breakdown comes on quicker, tiredness comes on quicker.
The older you get, the more likely these things are to occur. And it's really depressing to actually think about it, but it's why health and our well-being and everything that comes connected to it matters more the older we get. And what I try to do and what people really like from the way I speak is I try to get people to make these changes early in life to set themselves up, because then later in life, when these things do set in, they actually are in a better position to deal with having less naturally having less spoons each day, and naturally being able to do naturally consider all the things that they're more thoughtful of, kind of the where they are, what they need to consider. Yes, they've had their past, but they're thinking about the present, and so time isn't lost and so on.
Yeah, the I mean, it took me 55 years to realize that I didn't, you know, my energy was pretty poor. And then to have a label around it now, like in the last 3 weeks or so around spoons, is just, I mean, it actually did transform the way I think about what I do. And my wife keeps saying to me, you know, you can't do these things anymore. You can't. And I say, yes, I can. Of course I can. And then what happens is you go home, you feel shit, and you take it out on your family. And that's not right. So, look, Andy, on that thought, I mean, we all need to think about our spoon levels, I think, is the key to all of this. As a source of happiness in what you yourself decide to do. Andy, honestly, it's been fantastic. Thank you so much for your candidness.
Thank you for having me.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I don't know about anybody who's listening, but I've certainly got a hell of a lot out of this. So thank you. And I'm going to time date now this, or date stamp it, by saying Happy Christmas, which means that they'll probably have to edit that bit out.
Merry Christmas to anyone that's listening.
Yeah, all right. Anyway, cheers, Andy. Thanks ever so much.
Yeah, thank you ever so much.